the deposits at a bank account is literally just an entry into an Excel spreadsheet on someone's computer. That's what your money is. Primarily why I don't think we live in a truly free market. Like I mentioned, we have private ownership of capital, but at the base layer, the money, which is the tool that we use to facilitate all of the trade, that has a price control. When I found Bitcoin, I was like, oh, if I save this now, it's gonna be worth orders of magnitude more in the future. And so at that point, I became a net producer. I wasn't constantly consuming everything and spending all my money. I was producing more for society than what I was asking in return, i.e. consuming. Bitcoin really changes that dynamic where everyone's just out to serve others and create and create. And no, I don't need to consume. I don't need to buy that Rolex. I don't need to buy, you know, all this stuff I don't need. I just want to create and save in Bitcoin.
The Blockware marketplace is super cool. Basically, Mason's firm already helps investors and institutional investors on Wall Street get into Bitcoin mining with his giant data centers, but he wanted to make it even easier for the average person to get into this. So now with the Blockware marketplace, with the click of a button, you can buy your own Bitcoin miner from the comfort of your own home and have it instantly start mining for you straight into a Bitcoin wallet of your choosing. On the Blockware marketplace, you can see a bunch of miners for sale, you can see what the miner is, the price, the data center location that the miner is located in, the hash rate, the estimated revenue you're going to be making based on the current price of Bitcoin and stuff, and there are miners in all price ranges listed on there right now. Once you see a miner you want to look into more, simply click on it, and then you can see the serial number, how long it's been online for, you can see charts of the miner's historical performance, and once you're ready to buy a miner, simply click buy, follow the instructions, and then that miner that is already online in their data center will be instantly assigned to you. And that's it. You are now mining Bitcoin, getting all the benefits of mining without ever having to do any of the setup or maintenance yourself. So go to marketplace.blockwaresolutions.com to take a peek at all the miners that are listed for sale right now.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Blockware Intelligence Podcast. This week I have on Mitch Askew, or Mitchell Askew. Mitch, this is Blockware's very own. So Mitch has been doing on-chain at Blockware, runs the Blockware Twitter account, runs a lot of our marketing activities. Mitch is a Blockware legend and a Bitcoin legend. Mitch, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Joe. I'm excited to make my, I think it's my second podcast appearance. I think I was on earlier in the year when we talked to Danny about the marketplace. So I'm looking forward to it.
And we recorded the one in Kentucky, I think, right?
Oh, you're right. I forgot about that. That was a good one. Right when FTX went down and Bitcoin dropped to 16,000. So that was a good time for a pod.
That was crazy. That was the first ever in-person Blockware podcast. That was fun too.
Yeah, it was. And we had the moose head in the background. It was it was great. And it was something's funny, I guess, for the listeners. They might not know this, but the first two times you and I met in person, Bitcoin plummeted like 30% both of those weeks. So I was worried when we were going to the conference back in Miami. I'm like, oh no, it could happen again. But thankfully, not then.
I know it's, I feel like most of the times I ended up, maybe it was just us living through a bear market, but most of the times that we traveled, everything went down.
Yeah. It's everyone had it's to been sell. Quite a ride. I think we both started at Blockware basically at the top. So it's been interesting working in Bitcoin mining during all of this. I'm excited for the market to just hopefully turn around in the next few months.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I mean, we had epic timing. But you know, still here. Still crushing it. Marketplace is crushing it. Let's just jump right into it. First question that I have here, kind of in, you know, the words of Robert Breedlove, Mitch, what is money?
Yeah, so this is something obviously a lot of us in the Bitcoin community have thought about for a long time. And when you're just getting into Bitcoin, it seems like such a trivial question with such a simple answer, but the consequences really run quite deep. But on the surface level, money is just a tool. We have lots of tools in society, and money, that the function of this tool is it allows us to trade at scale. So when I'm thinking about the economy, just economics in general, it's really helpful to boil things down to the most primitive sort of society imaginable. And if it was just me and you on an island trying to survive, we wouldn't need money. We could just trade directly. Joe, you specialize in hunting rabbits, and I specialize in catching fish, and we share what we produce. But as society expands and there's more people, there's you can trust each other less, right? Because you don't know someone personally, so I can't give someone X amount of fish and hope they'll give me, you know, an equivalent amount of goods or whatever. So, and then also you have the coincidence of wants, right? So I produce fish or I catch fish, but the person who has the milk that I want or the steak, they might not want my fish, right? So we need some sort of intermediary good there to conduct that trade. And different monies have risen and fallen throughout human civilization. And the common similarities is that the ones that are the hardest to produce, they maintain their value over time the best, right? So gold is notorious. It was incredibly hard to produce, right? You have to actually dig and do some sort of proof of work. There's even, I heard someone mention this recently, it's like it has a natural difficulty adjustment too in the way, right? Because the easiest to find gold deposits right on the surface, you get those first. But as you get all the easy to find deposits, you have to start digging further. So yeah, basically money, it's necessary for any society to scale beyond just a couple of group guys or like a tribe or just like a small group of people that can trust each other. If you want any sort of scale, you need money to be able to conduct trade efficiently.
Yeah, completely agree. It's also interesting thinking about money just in our daily lives and people that I know, family, friends, their daily lives. We all like, you know, most of us at least have a job where we get paid a salary, and these green pieces of paper, we don't really know why they're green pieces of paper. We don't really know, like, you don't really know much. You don't really question it. Everyone's just like getting these green pieces of paper, getting a number into their bank account, and then spending those numbers into the economy. It's like no one really thinks about what exactly is money. It's just kind of like, it's kind of like that meme or that like analogy is like, the two fish are swimming down the stream, and then one fish is swimming back and he says, "How's the water today, boys?" And then the fish look at each other like, "What's water?" It's just like, it's stuff that like, money is kind of the same thing. Most 99.99% of the people just like pretend that this is how it is and how it always will be. In reality, yeah, that's not the case.
That's a great analogy with the fish. I hadn't heard that one, but you're spot on, right? People, they work for money and they save money. A lot of people, it's their whole life is just trying to make money, but few people actually stop to think what it is. And a friend of mine works at one of the major banks. I won't say which one, but I was looking at their work, and the deposits at a bank account is literally just an entry into an Excel spreadsheet on someone's computer. That's what your money is. And if you scale that up to all the way up to the Federal Reserve, right? The large banks in the world, they have an account at the Fed. It's just an entry on some Fed employee's Excel spreadsheet on their computer. That's all it is, right? It's so just like fake. People say Bitcoin is fake, but it's more so, you know, it's more real and tangible because it's actually connected to real energy in the real world. It's not just digits on someone's spreadsheet.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's a lot easier to change someone's spreadsheet or the Fed's database than it is to change 21 million Bitcoin.
Yeah, exactly.
Another question that I kind of want to get into, it's a little more deep, I guess, is from your perspective, what is capitalism and then what are free markets? And do you think they're the same, or do you try to like have different mindsets for each of those terms?
Yeah, great question. I definitely distinguish between the two, and here's why. So what is capitalism first? All right, well, what's capital? And I think a problem with our broken money and the fiat system is that everything is, when we think about economics and capital, it's all like financialized, right? People, they hear capital and they typically think money. Well, money is a form of capital, but it's not capital. And, you know, going back to sort of these primitive examples of society that I alluded to, capital is any tool, right? So I was catching fish and my fishing rod, that's capital. You were hunting rabbits, your spear, that's capital. A group of Indians and they have a tribe or whatever and they build shelters, like that's capital. It's any good you use to produce other goods, right? It doesn't exist purely for its own sake. So there's consumer goods, which is the fish, and then there's capital goods, which is the fishing rod. Or capital goods, there's some goods that are both, right? Like a car. If you use a car to drive Uber, you're using it as a capital good. But if you use it to just get from point A to point B, that's a consumer good. So capitalism is when individuals can have private ownership of capital versus like a socialist economy where the government controls capital, which capital is just the means of production. So capitalism is, you know, individuals controlling the means of production, where socialism or a centrally planned economy, the government controls the means of production. Where how I think about free markets is there's no government interference. And that may sound like the same thing on the surface, but you can have private ownership of capital while also having the government interfere with markets. Most notoriously, it's in the form of price controls. So you've got price floors and price ceilings where the government says you can't charge more than this for a good or service, or you have to charge at least this for a good or service, right? The most famous price control is minimum wage. So if you're selling your labor, which is the good there is labor, I'm working and I sell my labor, I have to charge at least $7.25 an hour, right? That's a price floor. Someone who's buying my labor, the employer, they have to pay me at least $7.25. And so what happens when you have a price floor is you get a surplus, right? So any worker, even if the value of my labor is less than the minimum wage, because they have to pay me that minimum wage, there's going to be more demand to produce labor, right? There's going to be more people wanting a job versus on the other side, the employers, not all of them can pay the $7.25 or whatever the minimum wage is. So there's going to be less demand on that side. So then you just get this gap. And I think price controls are the best example of how capitalism and free markets really differ, right? Because we have private ownership of capital, but the markets really aren't truly free. I think of a free market as absolutely, you know, no government interference or very, very minimal government interference. Basically, like, don't dump this toxic sludge into that river, or, you know, don't rob your neighbor, right, of his capital, and, you know, we're going to arrest you if you do that, right? I think at the bare minimum, government should just exist to protect other people's rights to capitalism and private ownership of goods and services.
Yeah, I agree. That's pretty fair. How does that tie in, I guess, to money itself?
Right. So this is something I've been thinking about a lot, and especially as I got into Bitcoin. And it's primarily why I don't think we live in a truly free market. Like I mentioned, we have private ownership of capital, but at the base layer, the money, which is the tool that we use to facilitate all of the trade, that has a price control. To borrow money, the interest rate, that's the price of money, right, is interest rates. And it's set centrally planned by the Federal Reserve. And functionally, you could think of it as a price floor, right? Because banks borrow from the Federal Reserve at the federal funds rate. Obviously, they're not going to lend that out at a rate lower than what they borrow from the Fed. So it's sort of a price floor. But I think of it more as a price ceiling. And here's why. So when the Federal Reserve artificially sets interest rates to basically near zero for the last 15 years, all banks are in competition with each other, right? Who can lend the most money is going to be the biggest, most successful, most profitable bank. So when the Federal Reserve sets interest rate at, you know, 0.1%, if JP Morgan, for example, starts charging 5% on loans they give out, well, Wells Fargo can charge 3%, right? So you get sort of this race down, like who could charge the lowest interest rate while, you know, still keeping a positive spread. Whereas if the price of money wasn't centrally planned, if there wasn't a federal funds, right, if there wasn't the Federal Reserve controlling the price of money, interest rates would likely be much higher. And so that it really, the consequences of that really bleed into a lot of the economy, which we can get into. And the biggest way is it causes capital to get misallocated, right? Going back to this primitive society that I love to use as an example, if you've got a group of 50 people and 25 of them are doing hard work, right? They're building, they're crafting tools, they're cultivating the land to do agriculture. But then you have the other half of the people that are destroying all of the work. They're stealing from other people. They're breaking down, you know, snapping the pickaxe in half and all of that. That's not going to be a very functional society. So that's the best way to think about capital destruction, capital misallocation, because, you know, when everything's super financialized and I say capital misallocation, people might think, oh, you know, that's just greedy businesses going under. But like, truly, you don't want capital misallocation in society because it makes us all poorer. And what the federal funds rate being manipulated and debt being artificially cheap allows, it allows for capital misallocation to happen at a much higher scale, right? There's this fear of business cycles. And, you know, you don't want companies going under, but that's really a natural phenomenon, right? If you're running a business and it's just unprofitable, you deserve to go out of business, right? You're destroying capital. You're not providing a net positive for the markets. But with debt being artificially cheap because there's effectively a price ceiling, which is the federal funds rate, there's an increase in demand for debt. And with the low interest rate, people can just, or businesses can continue to borrow and borrow and borrow when they're not even making profit and they're just able to service the interest rate, right? They're not even paying down the debt principal. And so when you have unprofitable businesses running amok through the society, that's really not good.
Yeah, I definitely think you're right there. I mean, it's quite interesting, like, thinking about it, right? Because I think fiat in general incentivizes, kind of as you're saying, capital misallocation. And the way it does that is by financing completely unprofitable businesses that really shouldn't exist, that are destroying capital. And then two, incentivizing more and more endless consumption and just short-term pleasure at the expense of the future, borrowing against the future. And then Bitcoin kind of comes in as maybe incentivizing more capital production rather than consumption today. So yeah, I think those are
100%. Yeah. And on that point, right, this is something I can't remember who I heard say it, but Bitcoin really, it shifts you from being, you know, that consumer mindset to a producer. Because if you're in a bunch of credit card debt and you're constantly spending more than you bring in income, Bitcoin's really of no use to you. You don't have any money to save, right? And Bitcoin's the ultimate savings technology. That's its killer application. And personally, I can attest to this. Before I found Bitcoin, I was in that mindset. I was just like, all right, well, I'm only, you know, 20 years old. I don't need to start worrying about retirement or any sort of, you know, savings. I'm just going to make what I make at my job and I'm going to spend it on stuff I want. When I found Bitcoin, I was like, oh, if I save this now, it's going to be worth orders of magnitude more in the future. And so at that point, I became a net producer. I wasn't constantly consuming everything and spending all my money. I was producing more for society than what I was asking in return, i.e. consuming. And so, yeah, Bitcoin really changes that dynamic where everyone's just out to serve others and create. And no, I don't need to consume. I don't need to buy that Rolex. I don't need to buy, you know, all this stuff I don't need. I just want to create and save in Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, the point that you made about how originally you weren't really big into saving, and then you discovered Bitcoin, and that as a tool, you know, incentivize you to actually save more, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, part of it was like I was so young and I just didn't see it necessary. But then I realized, like, you're never too young to start saving for the future, right? And that, I guess that's really that idea of time preference that Saifedean popularized, instead of just worrying about, you know, what am I going to do this weekend or, you know, what's going down? I'm like, wow, I'm actually, you know, I'm going to be in my 30s in only 10 years. And at that point, I'm going to want to start having children or whatnot. So I need to start saving for the future now, right? It's not just going to, nobody's going to save for me. I have to start producing more than I'm going to consume and save the surplus of Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like people come to, you know, understand Bitcoin and learn more about Bitcoin from like so many different perspectives. I can definitely see that perspective. And I've, like, for me personally and other people I've known, is they're big into investing, whether they're younger or post-college or in college. And they realize, like, wow, this is like kind of broken system. Like, you would be like modeling out, you know, the future, the value of an equity with its future cash flows and using like a discount rate, and everything seemed priced in, everything seemed super overvalued. And then all of a sudden we have a recession, like everything would go down, everything, and then you'd buy, but then everything would get pumped back up. And the whole economy like felt like a Ponzi type thing, because like the unit of account was basically broken when you're performing like any sort of financial analysis. And I feel like some people come to Bitcoin that way as well. So quite interesting.
Yeah, for
sure. Other point that, or are you going to bring up something there?
Oh no, I was just going to say, you know, there's tons of different paths, right? Bitcoin touches on so many different aspects of society, because money touches so many different aspects of society. Partially, I came into Bitcoin through that lens of, all right, it's time to start and maturing and saving for the future. And it was also, hey, I see our systems are breaking down, right? I don't trust anything I'm hearing from the media. I don't trust anything that the government's telling me. I'm competent enough with basic math to see that they just increased the money supply by 30% in a single year. That's probably not good. We're probably going to get inflation, which I've heard about but never really paid attention to, because why would that happen in America? We're not some South American country or African country, right? That we're not a banana republic. That we wouldn't get hyperinflation here. But our fiat system is no different than any of the other paper monies that have been tried in history, right? So it could 100% happen here. And yeah, so many different avenues to arrive at the conclusion, which is Bitcoin.
Yeah. Also, like, talking to people that, you know, are regular people, don't work in finance, maybe make a decent income, maybe don't make a decent income. I feel like most people believe that money is kind of broken, or they're like, what the heck? Like, you know, an 08 massive, you know, $800 billion stimulus package comes out. They're like, this is weird. Like, that doesn't seem good. And then we have 2020 COVID and $3 trillion of dollars of stimulus surpassed. And they're like, wait, what the heck? Like, this is like magnitudes larger than 2008. And, you know, it's like everyone kind of knows that something is off, but they don't really know what exactly it is.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely.
Another question that I have is related to a podcast we recorded with Stampseed, the Stampseed guys, but I think it's a super interesting question. Do you see similarities between Bitcoin and like the foundation of America?
Yeah, 100%. And my Twitter banner profile is actually the founding fathers with laser eyes when they were signing the Declaration of Independence. And I, maybe this is just like me being nostalgic or, you know, longing for the good old days of the American Revolution. I'm really fascinated with that part of history, but I really do believe Bitcoiners are the modern day equivalent. We're revolutionaries in a sense, right? We're trying to bring forth a new, better system from the one that we're currently under. But I think there's one really key distinction, and I love the Constitution. I think it's great. But a key point is that the Constitution is not what gives you rights, right? And this is part of the ethos of America. Our rights pre-exist government. They don't come from government. They don't come from the Constitution. They come from God. And the Constitution is just basically like, hey, government, you're not allowed to interfere with X, Y, and Z, right? You're not allowed to infringe on our right to say what we want, to worship how we want, to bear arms, to have property. But at the end of the day, and this is really, I think, Jason Lowry's key thesis, is that that's just a logical system, right? There's no power behind the Constitution. It's just a piece of encoded logic, a piece of paper, and it relies on trust. You have to trust the government doesn't interfere with your rights. You have to trust that the Supreme Court actually upholds the true constitutional values. And trust is a big security flaw, right? Where with Bitcoin, it has this physical defense mechanism of like real energy that I can say whatever I want via a transaction, and I can have property with Bitcoin, and there's no interfering, right? It's not asking for permission. It's giving you freedom of speech. It's giving you property rights in a way that can't actually be infringed upon by government, which the Constitution, as great as it is, and as much as I agree with the items in it, it can be infringed upon, and it is, right? Do we truly have property rights when our money is devalued without our permission? I don't think so. But Bitcoin, the stereotypical phrase, right? Bitcoin fixes this.
Yeah, completely agree. I mean, you made an interesting point how like the Constitution itself doesn't necessarily give you rights. It's more of limiting those natural rights from being taken away from you by the government, which is effectively other people. So it's like preventing other people from taking away just your natural rights, which I think is super interesting.
Exactly. And I mean, that's a great framework to put it, but does it stop it from happening is ultimately what it boils down to. And I think that's why the Second Amendment is the second one, right? Because that's sort of the last defense of all the other amendments. But with Bitcoin, it kind of has this Second Amendment built into it. And that if you try to attack the network, you're just going to be met with a giant wall of energy, and you're going to have to burn so much energy just to even try to attack it. And even then, your attack's just not going to be sustainable. So that's definitely how I sort of think about Bitcoin and the Constitution.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think of the Constitution and like a Bitcoin full node as being pretty similar, right? Like the Constitution limits other people, the government, from taking away your rights. A Bitcoin full node is code that you run on your computer, rules that you enforce on your own computer that prevents other people outside, you know, that are on Bitcoin or not on Bitcoin from taking away your rights that you put on your Bitcoin full node, which could be something like 21 million Bitcoin. You make that rule and you impose that rule on yourself and the network of whoever wants to join your network. And no one outside your computer can change the rules on your own computer.
Yeah, I like that. I hadn't thought about it like that. The, you know, effectively the consensus rules are, I have freedom of speech, I have freedom of property, I have freedom to bear arms. That's similar to the 21 million and to the 10-minute block times and the difficulty adjustment and the halving. That's, those are all the consensus rules, and if you try to break them, all right, we're gonna revert to the Constitution as basically the decider of things. And another comparison between Bitcoin and the American Revolution is that America is the OG decentralization, right? First off, you have 50 states, 13 at the founding, and they all have their own rights. So if the federal government's doing something that the states don't agree with, they can tell them to F off, right? And so if you don't like how one state's governing, you could go to a different state and live there. And so the power is distributed in that way. And then if you break it down even further, we have the judicial branch, the legislative branch, and the executive branch, and they all have to sort of intermingle. And similar to how Bitcoin, you talk about this a lot, is designed to not change, right? Changing Bitcoin is very hard. In the same way, passing laws in this country is very hard, and that's a feature, not a bug. You don't want one person to be able to change the rules of America, right? You want it to be a grindy process, and you have to get through lots of hoops. Not to say that, you know, it's impossible to make changes in this country, and clearly I think it's gotten easier to make negative changes and infringe on people's rights. Certain areas of the government have been leveraged to do so. I would say specifically is sort of the three-letter agencies, right? They're unelected officials. They're not necessarily bound to any sort of voting constituent, like the Fed, the FBI, the IRS, the TSA, all of those. I think they're probably the biggest infringers at the moment. But in the design, America was decentralized, and it still is to this day. Ultimately, the states are what's really holding America as a bastion of freedom. You've had, during all of the COVID madness and lockdowns, Florida became a home for freedom. Texas became a home for freedom. Tennessee, a bunch of other states. And we don't have to, I mean, we can shift gears to this, but I think that's how Bitcoin ultimately plays out. Because I don't see the federal government, their incentive, right, is to delay sort of a Bitcoin standard for as long as possible, right? They want to preserve the fiat system. They want to maintain the ability to print money and fund their operations that way, because ultimately they can't do it through just taxation. They need the money printer. But the states aren't incentivized in the same way. The states are more incentivized to care about their local people, their economy and everything, and maintaining sovereignty from a financial sense, right? They don't want their citizens to have their bank accounts frozen for saying the wrong thing. They don't want any of that, and they don't want inflation in their county or their town or their state, right? So I think we see Bitcoin adoption occur from a state level up sort of thing. And I mean, it's really already playing out. A lot of the legislation for Bitcoin's come at the state level so far.
Yeah, I mean, the states can't print their own money, so it makes sense that they would, you know, not want to follow the rules of someone that can print their own money and take their assets and do whatever they want. Same with nation states, right? Like we see something like El Salvador come out. Like, if they don't have the privilege of being able to create US dollars at will and finance whatever projects they want to finance, they might as well just adopt Bitcoin and save Bitcoin and issue bonds to buy Bitcoin of the IMF or whoever is going to actually buy those bonds. And then just hold Bitcoin. Like, if you don't have a money printer, you might as well just hold the best money. There is. And I would argue, like, even if you do have a money printer, you should probably just print money and buy the best monetary tool that there ever will be.
Yeah, I would agree. But I don't think they've figured that out yet. If they have, they're doing it under the table in a way that we can't necessarily grasp. But you're 100% right and about, you know, the states and comparing them to other nations. And I think people often, myself included, forget that an individual state, like, it's its own sovereign entity. I think, what is it, New York and California would be like the top 10 or top 5 states in terms of GDP, which is not that GDP is like indicative of anything, but it's the best metric we have for determining economic output. But like, individual states within America possess a lot of power, more power than other countries. So when they don't have access to a money printer, like you said, so they're incentivized to adopt Bitcoin. Anyone without a money printer, your best option, if you're not the global reserve currency, is to choose some sort of neutral currency that others can't manipulate.
Yeah, 100%. Talking about the U.S. more generally, I guess, is the U.S. government bankrupt?
Sorry to interrupt. Mitch here in post-production. And before you hear me answer that question, I want to share a quick word about this video's sponsor, which is none other than Blockware Solutions. Blockware is the top ASIC broker in the world and is without a doubt the best way to secure Bitcoin mining hardware. There's a lot of bullish catalysts on the horizon for Bitcoin, with the FASB accounting ruling, a potential spot ETF, the 2024 halving, and potential rate cuts by the Fed next year. With all these reasons to be bullish, you're going to want to accumulate a Bitcoin position. And the best way to do that, without a doubt, is through Bitcoin mining. We've published a lot of resources recently on the 2024 halving, and the best way you can prepare as a miner is to secure the most efficient machines possible, as well as the lowest electricity rate possible. If you're listening to this video on the day it comes out, on September 8th, then you have until midnight tonight to purchase any ASIC through Blockware, and you will receive 7-cent hosting. Paying 7 cents per kilowatt hour instead of our typical rate of 8 cents per kilowatt hour will save you 12.5% every month in terms of operating expenses for your Bitcoin mining endeavors. This is a very limited time opportunity, so if you want to get started mining today, go to marketplace.blockwaresolutions.com and you can buy as few as one rig. And if you're interested in a bulk order, send us an email, sales@blockwaresolutions.com, or DM us on Twitter. The link to our profile is in the description. But without further ado, let's get back to the episode. Simply put, I would say yes, and I'm no macro guru. I definitely take a left side of the bell curve approach to this. But when you look at their government as a balance sheet, right? They can generate revenue, taxation. They can take your money by, yeah, taxes. That's how they generate revenue. And then they have all these programs that they spend money on, right? Military spending and Social Security, stuff that they cannot get rid of because it would be political suicide. You have millions and millions of boomers that need Social Security. Now, if we were starting society from scratch, we don't need Social Security, right? But thinking at the margin, where are we now going forward? We have to pay out these people because otherwise there's just going to be madness, right? You're going to have all of these old people that just don't have any way to live, right? They can't go back to work. So that money has to be spent. We cannot limit spending in that regard. Now, there's plenty of areas that you could limit spending, but are the politicians going to? No, they're not. All those three-letter agencies I mentioned before, they could be defunded and cut off, but that's not going to happen, right? So the only way left to fill that gap, because you've got spending up here and you've got revenue down here, is to print money. And this gap just continues to grow. And as long as the federal funds rate stays where it's at, the interest there is just going to continue to grow. So the only way to cover that gap is to effectively print money. And it's going to happen in a lot of different ways. They're going to have all these sorts of different programs with fancy names. And they're not going to outright say, yeah, we're printing money. Because part of what makes fiat not work, but what has allowed it to survive as long as it has, is the obfuscation of what's really happening. I think that's why 2% is the target inflation rate, because if people don't know that they're being stolen from by inflation, they're not going to care. But so having 2% is like the boiling frog theory, like they don't feel it, right? So they have to sort of hide what's going on, but they can only do that for so long, right? 2020 was definitely a tipping point once we got all of the high CPI prints, which CPI also manipulated, also fake, but inflation just got so bad to the point where everyone noticed, right? People still talk about inflation to this day. Normies that frankly don't really care about any sort of things with finance or economics, they just feel it when they go to live their day-to-day lives. And like we hit on earlier, there's so many consumers out there, right? And the consumers are getting hurt with inflation. So yeah, I guess I'm not really sure where I'm going with that, but yeah, I guess, yeah, your original question, is the US government bankrupt? Absolutely. It's just a matter of, you know, how long can they continue to operate and misallocate capital?
Yeah. And yeah, you made some good points, like Social Security and other military spending. I don't think that they're ever going to really be able to cut any of that to any degree, like you're talking about.
It's imagine a politician running on the platform. Yeah, that we're gonna get rid of the military and just no military, or we're gonna get rid of Social Security. Boomers, good luck, have fun. Like, they're not gonna get elected. That's just not gonna happen. So that spending is locked in for the next few decades.
Completely agree. Right? It's like, first of all, maybe like Ron Paul or other like historically like more libertarian type candidates would run on a platform like that, and obviously not come anywhere really close to ever getting elected. And theoretically, even if someone like that did get elected and drastically cut spending, decided to actually run a budget surplus, in my view, basically the entire global economy would come to like a screeching halt, because we're all about that short-term consumption, creating more debt, being able to finance that debt, keep the train rolling. The moment that you stop the massive spigot of money coming out of the US government, the economy really starts to falter. And then all of a sudden we're like voting for anything to bail out the banks or bail out these companies and keep the train going. So it's like, if that guy actually did get elected and we did cut spending, things would get so bad so fast, like 2008 or like 2020, that the whole ship would get reversed really quickly and someone else would come into office and pump the economy back up again. So
yeah, I think it's like the ultimate can kicking mechanism, right? Business cycles would be a normal process, right? Like we talked about earlier, bad companies should get wiped out. But when you allow them to survive for longer, the wipeout is just nastier. And that's happening at scale. If you just think from, you know, first principles, like in the most simplest way, in 2020, everyone stopped working. Like the entire real world, the real economy, goods and services just grinded to a halt. That should induce a recession because we're not producing anything. But what did they do? They printed a bunch of money. So the recession was like one quarter long, when in reality it should have been fairly nasty. They just kicked that can down the road. They punted it off, you know, a few years down the line, and eventually the consequences are going to come due. And like they've always done, they're just going to print their way out of it and bail out the capital misallocators. If you ever read The Creature from Jekyll Island, great book, highly recommend it. There's like 50 pages of just bailout information, like statistics about all these bailouts that have happened. Not even talking about like 08 and recently, just throughout all of fiat's lifetime, it's just the entire story has been bailouts, which is I think the best quote to encapsulate it is, I'm borrowing this from Matthew Crater. It's, you know, privatize the profits and socialize the losses. Companies and banks specifically have all of the upside and they don't have any of the downside, because if they misallocate capital, they make bad loans, they're just going to get bailed out.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely what we've seen happen. And I agree that it'll probably continue to happen, at least in the short to medium term. It's also interesting. I heard like Lynn Alden mentioned this before, that, you know, governments spending a lot of money and running these massive deficits, fiat banks, central banks and commercial banks basically loaning money into existence, and that's how like the system works today. I don't think it's necessarily any particular person or group of people's fault. It's like those were the tools that were available at the time of trying to like run an economy or run a business and run the world and create civilization, and that's just like the natural way that things were always going to play out. Like if you went back 2,000 years and or even longer and tried to like change up some fewer variables at the beginning or put people elsewhere, we'd probably end up running into the same exact problems later. And it's now that Bitcoin exists, a new tool exists, then that's maybe going to change how civilization will like organize economically and financially. And it's not just because we woke up and told people about Bitcoin. It's because Bitcoin just simply exists. It's like the airplane now simply exists. You're going to like, the world is going to change around the airplane in a big way, as it has. And without the airplane, the world's going to look a little different. Like the way people transport things, the way people transport themselves is going to be very different from post airplane. Same with money, except money is so like foundational to everything that we do. It has to do with our job, with our businesses, with our government. It's going to be very transformational, and we may not even be able to like envision how different the world could be, because it's like going back to that analogy of the fish in the water. Like, what is water? Like, money is so instrumental to our society, just like water is so important to a fish, that we don't even know the changes that are about to take place.
Yeah, 100%. Money touches every industry. If you had manipulation and capital controls in any other industry, it'll mostly be contained to that industry, right? When San Francisco had rent controls and landlords weren't allowed to charge more than X amount for rent, obviously you had a surge in demand and less supply, and so there was a shortage there. But that problem is contained to the San Francisco real estate market, right? But when you have capital controls and the cost of money, and money is used in every industry, it's going to affect the entire economy. And you brought up Lynn Alden's point, and I think this is fascinating. And her point is that fiat had to happen, right? As humanity developed technologically and we were able to communicate and trade faster, we needed a currency that could keep up with that, because gold was unable to. And fiat's just sort of this constant battle of gold versus gold claims, and it had to happen. And now that we've reached Bitcoin, it's like, all right, now we can progress beyond that murky fiat stage. And one point of my own that I want to add in there is that's all fine and dandy, except they banned private gold ownership in what was it, 1933? So like, if we're going to do this fiat game, at least allow people to save in gold, right? And hold hard assets. Let us buy real estate without a 2% property tax, right? Let us invest in stocks without taking a 30% cap gains hit, right? There's the ways you have to protect against the fiat debasement. Those are also being taxed. And really, there's quite frankly nowhere to hide up until 2009. Now there is a place to hide where they can't touch it. They can't do anything. They can't tax it because I lost my Bitcoin in a boating accident, right? Tax the 12 words in my head. It just doesn't work. So this is an entirely new system that we can all step into, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, and you know, free markets to me work very well when there's a lack of friction, right? When you specialize in your thing, I specialize in my thing, and someone else specializes in their thing, and then we all at the end of the day collaborate and trade with each other, and that is why like we have such advanced things like the internet and computers and cars and airplanes. It's like, it's kind of quite amazing that we've come this far when you recognize how many, you know, how much friction is really out there, whether it's like income tax or sales tax or property tax. It's like, there's so much real friction out there that if we started to like eliminate some of this friction and make it easier for people to trade freely and prices were reflected more naturally as if like there wasn't this interference, imagine like where the world would be today. Like it would be, we could be like way drastically more advanced to where people don't really have to work that much, whether it's like AI or robots or whatever. People can do whatever they think is best.
Yeah, I definitely agree. There's so many frictions in the economy. And I think something that goes understated, in my opinion, we all know how bad fiat is as a store of value. We all know how bad it is as a medium of exchange. But I think the ultimate friction is how it is as a unit of account. And I think this ultimately leads to why we have these more massive business cycles and misallocation of capital. It's hard to make analysis, right? It's hard to know how the future is going to play out when you don't know what the money's going to be worth. if you even try to make comparisons to 2019, just like looking at a balance sheet or doing any kind of accounting, anything where fiat is the unit of account, it's hard to compare 4 years ago to today. And that change is just only going to happen faster. So making these economic calculations when the tool you're using to make measurements is broken, it just doesn't work, right? If you are trying to build a house and what's 1 meter today is 2/3 of a meter tomorrow, and you're trying to communicate with the architect, it's not going to work, right? And you've got the plumber, he needs to know what a meter is. The electrician, they need to know what a meter is, right? These are specializations. These are all the different facets of the economy, and we're all using one unit of account that just doesn't work, right? So when I say, you know, $100 and next year I'm also saying $100, it doesn't mean the same thing, right? So you need truth, you need definitions, you need facts, and fiat is not that, but Bitcoin is.
Yeah, it's a really good point. It's like you're using a yard today and then tomorrow you wake up and decide to use a meter and then you think it's the same. It's people don't realize they're doing that, but that's exactly what they're doing when they're running some sort of financial analysis, which is like completely backwards when you need a tool that's actually not changeable and immutable, or the most immutable. Looking back, I guess, over the last 20, 30, maybe 50 years, do you think the middle class, specifically in America, but I guess even globally, has been gutted to some extent?
Definitely in America. I can't speak on globally, and maybe this is, I know it's like a stereotype of like arrogant Americans. I think we're the only country, but I'm sure I fall into that. I just sort of pay attention to what's going on here, but absolutely. And I think there's three primary reasons, which stem from one reason, which is the broken money, right? As productivity has increased, our compensation in terms of dollars has not, right? So GDP has risen and wages have stayed relatively flat. And it's hard to save for the future, right? Because the money is so broken, you can't store your value today and know that you'll have access to it tomorrow. And like I've mentioned already on this pod, the broken money and the ability to print has allowed the government to finance a lot of arguably worthless and destructive programs, the foremost being welfare, right? When you financially incentivize people to not work, when you pay them to stay unmarried and to, you know, just have kids out of wedlock, that's going to destroy the family unit, which is ultimately it's what drives the economy, right? Because families are so built on trust, right? I don't need to use money within my family, or I can, you know, I can support my brother, right? Or my son, or, you know, families can support each other. Unlike government. So you need family units to have a strong middle class. And, you know, the gutting of the family unit is what's gutted the middle class.
Yeah, great point. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of sad, like, thinking about it now, how little people, like, owning a house, like, most people that are young, I don't even know how they would ever really own a house in, like, a decent area at this point, unless they're making, you know, really good money, which obviously, if you're making really good money, someone else is not making it. It's really good relative to everybody else, I guess. So yeah, I mean, I feel like the incentives are against younger people obtaining assets, real wealth, and that's not going to work out well. Like if, you know, people that are 25, 30 years old went to school and borrowed all this money and are in a deep hole and they're never going to be able to get out of it. And maybe the older generation has a lot of wealth and it's artificially propped up and keeps get artificially propped up. And then it's not like, to me, it's not surprising to see like ideas like socialism arise when it's clearly the middle class is being gutted. The people that don't have much are like, you know, deep and it's hard for them to ever catch back up to the top. And then the people in the top can make bad decisions or decent decisions and still have their assets go from, you know, 50 million to 60 million to 70 million without making, you know, without really doing too much for society. So it's like, we need Bitcoin to come in and fix this.
Yeah. And a lot of the blame just gets put on everything else, right? Other than the money being broken, which to me is just so strange, because it really is the root of the problem stem from the money just not working. And yeah, I think as what we've seen so far is the millennials and then Gen Z, both of these generations are less inclined to have children and to have savings. And that's really quite sad to see. And I'd like to be vocal and change that. But thankfully, we have Bitcoin as a solution. If we didn't have Bitcoin as an actual solution, I think I might be part of the group that's just like complaining about everything else, right? And pointing fingers at everything except the real root of the problem, which is fiat money.
Yeah. In your mind, I'm always interested to hear people's perspective on this. How do you differentiate Bitcoin from crypto?
That's a fun question. And it's that Bitcoin can't change, right? Crypto can change. Crypto is manipulated. Crypto has founders. I think the founder thing is huge, right? We don't know who Satoshi is. If Satoshi, wearing his shirt, if Satoshi came back today and tried to change 21 million, we would tell him to get out of here. Like, we're not doing that. Like, I'm not changing the rules on my node, right? So the fact that there's nobody in charge to change the rules is what makes Bitcoin so different from crypto. All the other cryptos have a group of people that are in charge. You have Vitalik of ETH. You have Charles Hoskinson's of the one he does. I don't even remember their names at this point. There's just so many, and they can change it. Vitalik changed ETH from proof of work to proof of stake. If the government makes one call to Vitalik, your ETH is, you know, they can do whatever they want to it, right? They can stop, they can ban your wallet from doing whatever because they control the network. It's proof of stake. It's not actually decentralized. That's what it's all about. It's decentralization and censorship resistant and making a new money. I think another key distinction is you have crypto, which is trying to fix all these other problems. There's only one problem I'm concerned about fixing, and that's the money, right? I don't care about, you know, I need to be able to lend to some counterparty I don't know and guarantee yield. That doesn't exist, right? Any sort of investment is going to have risk. There's no such thing as risk-free returns, and that's just this fiat mindset that's been pushed out there. Again, boil it down to the most simple, bare-bones sort of economy. If I'm running a business, and let's say I'm going to do a bakery, right? I need to go buy like an industrial oven. I need to go buy a place to do it. I need to get yeast and sugar and wheat and whatever you need to make bread. It could go wrong, right? I could not run a profit. It could go horribly. So this idea that you can just give someone else money and they can guarantee turn it into more money and give you a return is just false. Anything can go wrong. Which is, you know, why you need to save, right? And you need to save in something that's going to maintain its purchasing power. Savings and investing have been confuddled, right? You save in stocks, you save in real estate, you save in gold and bonds and all this stuff. When stuff can go wrong, your house can get wiped out by a tornado, your company can go under, but Bitcoin is savings. And, you know, one Bitcoin's always going to equal one Bitcoin going into perpetuity.
Yeah. You brought up an interesting point about crypto versus Bitcoin. It's like taking a step back. If the world actually just did discover immutable scarcity, which happens to be censorship-resistant money, money that, you know, you can have, hold, and spend, and no one can tell you that you can't do that, or no one can stop you from doing that. And this money is, like we talked about, money is transformational to civilization itself. It's a massive deal, and Bitcoin, if that is correct and Bitcoin doesn't break, which I don't think it will, Bitcoin will go from zero to, you know, $100+ trillion asset in a few decades, which would be pretty, it would be like probably bigger than the internet, probably bigger than any technology that we've witnessed in our lifetimes. And then you have crypto where it's like, we've created a way to create monkey JPEGs and send them to each other back and forth. It's like, where even are you? Like, what planet are you on? It's like, yeah, we just discovered the airplane and you are like playing like tic-tac-toe with your friend. It's like, what is going on?
Yeah, it's just foolish nonsense. Like, we're here to fix money itself. We're not here to do anything else. If you want to do all this crypto stuff, all right, let's make a deal. How about we get to a Bitcoin standard first, right? Let's make this work, and then you can go play around and do what you think you got to do with these other crypto assets and other blockchains. And there was one more point I was going to make, but now I've lost it.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's like, sure, like some of this stuff could be cool and like interesting, but to me, it's like you didn't discover, you don't realize, if we're right about Bitcoin, how crazy it is that we're right about it, and like how we've recognized it for 99.9% of the world. Because it's so crazy.
And the thing is, it's like their argument is, well, I can make more returns in this thing. It's like, can you really make more returns than buying the next money itself, right? This is the money. Buy the money. Don't buy this other pseudo token equity sort of thing. And I guess there's a greed element to it, but I don't even like to say that it's greed, because all these shitcoins go to zero in terms of Bitcoin. So like, is it greed, or is it just, you know, high time preference? Like, let me get in and out and back into Bitcoin. I think there's a lot of that from the founders of these crypto tokens, not necessarily the people that buy into the ideas that they're saying, but the people who are actually, you know, launching tokens and crypto, they seem to get Bitcoin, right? But I think American HODL said it, they like your Bitcoin. They want your Bitcoin. So they're going to sell you this token so they can take those proceeds and go buy Bitcoin.
Exactly. Yeah. They're interested in Bitcoin. They're just interested in your Bitcoin. That was a great quote from him. It's just kind of silly, I guess. It's funny. But another question that I have for you is, what's going on with Binance? Do you have an opinion on that?
I'm not super in the weeds, but, you know, anybody can look at Binance and tell something sketchy is going on. It's hard to tell because it's so like shadow banking, like obfuscated. But if you just look at the chart of BNB to USD or BNB to BTC, there's clearly some support line that's being held up. And I don't understand how you can have the entire crypto environment, all the crypto assets going down, Bitcoin included, but BNB like goes up. And we've had a few of those days in the past few months, and clearly there's some support level being held, and the only party who would have any interest in doing that is CZ. And at the root of it, Binance token is not anything. It's an air token, no different than all of these other cryptos. It's not backed by proof of work. It doesn't have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of nodes verifying its consensus. It's just some token that is used for I don't even know what, right? It's what can you even do with BNB? Is it censorship resistant money that you can take anywhere and know it's going to have the same immutable supply going forward? I don't think it's that. So the only person who could be interested in propping it up is Binance themselves, which the only question there then is why, right? Do they probably don't have liabilities against it. That would be stupid, but yeah, I guess you can't put anything past them. And the one final point I guess I'll make there is just get your Bitcoin off of Binance. If I'm wrong and I'm just a FUD spreader and Binance is perfectly solvent, no harm, no foul, right? But if I'm right and they don't have all the Bitcoin that they say they have, because there's no way to know how much Bitcoin they've sold, right? How many claims exist out there? That's private information. They're not a publicly traded company publishing all of their liabilities. We could look on chain and see how much Bitcoin they have, but we don't know how many they allegedly sold, right? We don't know if there's a mismatch there. So don't keep your Bitcoin on Binance or any exchange for that matter.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we can try to estimate how much Bitcoin they have on chain, whether it's 400,000 Bitcoin or whatnot, but if everyone logged into their Binance account right now and you summed those values up and it's 800,000 Bitcoin, then we've got a little mismatch there. And you know, you want to be the first one to get your real Bitcoin before you find out that you don't actually have any Bitcoin.
Yeah. I mean, self-custody is Bitcoin in a nutshell. Bitcoin isn't logging into an exchange and trading it, buying, selling dollars or asking them to send it to someone else. Bitcoin is this own separate protocol that doesn't exist connected to any of that. So you need to get your stake in that protocol. And it doesn't exist when Binance is holding your Bitcoin for you. Taking Bitcoin off the exchange and putting it into self-custody is a big responsibility. And if you're going to do that, which you should, you need to make sure your seed phrase is secure. Simply writing it down on a piece of paper is not the best way to go about it. All sorts of things can go wrong when you do that. You're going to want to stamp it into metal. Using one of Stampseed's metal plates, you can ensure that your seed phrase is immune to fire damage, water damage, and just general erosion that happens over time. Head to Stampseed.com and use the code BLOCKWARE15 for 15% off at checkout, and you'll sleep much sounder at night knowing that your Bitcoin seed phrase is stamped securely into a metal plate.
Yeah, and I mean, anyone that holds Bitcoin wants NGU technology, number go up technology, and a key part of that is 21 million Bitcoin. If there's way more than 21 million Bitcoin, then we're kind of, what are we doing here to begin with? And so it's like, the only way you can prove that you actually hold the Bitcoin is by taking self-custody and running a full node and verifying that you actually received those coins. And then on your node, you can see that, oh, there's, you know, 19 million Bitcoin right now, or 20 million Bitcoin right now. And so it's like, everyone is incentivized to take self-custody, because if you're trusting someone else to tell you that you have Bitcoin, they could be lying to you. And so it's like, when they're lying, and if there's a lot of people lying, whether it's FTX or Binance or whoever, then there are actually more than 21 million Bitcoin. And by, you know, getting your Bitcoin, you can say, like, actually there's Bitcoin is more scarce than everyone in the world previously thought, and therefore the price might actually go up more after everyone takes self-custody. So, and it's also like, when someone else wants to go buy Bitcoin, they log into Coinbase or Michael Saylor or whoever tries to buy, you know, another $1 billion worth of Bitcoin. If there's not much Bitcoin out there, and, you know, where does the price go? It goes a lot higher just to buy the existing Bitcoin that's still out there, which is trending down, as we've talked about.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess the big thing over the past few months has been an ETF. And someone may take what you just said about self-custody, which is 100% true, and I agree with all of it, and say, well, the ETF is going to be all this custodial Bitcoin, right? They're going to do paper Bitcoin on top of that and use it to suppress the price. And to that, I would just say, have at it. Like, let them try it. Every time someone has tried to do fractional reserve Bitcoin, it eventually goes bust, because unlike gold, when gold is fractionally reserved, you're not going to get swaths of people going to withdraw it at the same time, because you actually have to physically get off your butt and go do it. And first, before that, you even have to hear that, oh, it could be fractionally reserved. Like, it has to become a concern. But we live in the internet where everybody can hear about, oh, FTX doesn't have all the Bitcoin they say they have, and they can go on their mobile phone and hit withdraw in 60 seconds. And you got millions of people doing that at the same time. So anybody who does fractionally reserve Bitcoin, it's only a matter of time before it eventually goes bust. And I seriously doubt that, you know, BlackRock or Fidelity would be, especially Fidelity, because they've been in Bitcoin for a while. They get it. I doubt they would actually try to fractionally reserve an ETF. But even if they do, it's in the end, it's good for Bitcoin when that scheme inevitably goes under.
Yeah, makes it cheaper to acquire real Bitcoin, if that's what they're doing, or if that is what they end up doing, which in the long run is good for people buying real Bitcoin. One of the last questions that I have for you is, how do you think Bitcoin will transform civilization itself?
I think the biggest transformation will be less government impact in people's lives. And that ultimately is what led me down the rabbit hole. When government doesn't have the ability to print money and use the inflation tax, because that's what it is, they're not going to be able to fund a lot of what they do, right? It's going to restructure all of the incentives, because they're going to have to spend money wisely. They can't just burn it on nothing programs that people don't actually want and don't support. So it's going to limit the ability of the federal government to mess with people's property rights. And I think ultimately that scales down. So when the federal government has less impact on your lives, you know, maybe the state government will also have a little less impact on your lives, and we can get back to just our living amongst our community. And, you know, for example, a lot of cities are notorious for specialization, right? Detroit was like the car hub, and Hollywood and LA was the entertainment hub, and the South was agriculture. And then we go out and trade with the other societies out there. And I think we're really going to boil back down to that level, right? So this area of the world, they're going to specialize in whatever they produce, and they're going to be able to trade with the rest of the world in a friction-free manner. And everybody's going to be able to save wealth and plan for the future. And there'll be a lot less uncertainty when you're trying to build a family, and you know, the you're going to interact with your local officials more, and there's not going to be as much bickering from, all right, let's, who's going to be the president this year? Like, it, does that really matter? No. What matters more is, like, who's your mayor? Like, who, what's your county commissioner? Like, what's going on in your environment? So I think politics will still exist, but it'll be much more prominent on the local level, and you'll really won't really care who's in the White House at that point.
Yeah, 100%. Last question, then we can probably wrap it up. Similar to what you just talked about, but hyper-Bitcoinization, I guess, do you think it's going to happen? Do you buy into the, like, price target ideas of, like, Luke Broyles, Peter Dunworth, which I do on a long enough time horizon? And, like, how do you see, this has turned into, like, three questions, but for hyper-Bitcoinization, people that are early to Bitcoin, how do you see wealthy Bitcoiners, like, spending their time as well?
The price prediction I buy into is Wicked Smart's stock to FOMO. I just don't think you can price dollars in Bitcoin in the same breath, right? Eventually, I think fiat will not exist. If that's in my lifetime, I don't know. I think probably. I'm only 23 years old. I don't think that fiat can survive another 50 years. So what I try to do when thinking about this, these sort of ideas, is price Bitcoin in terms of goods and services. And I put out a tweet the other day, and it's talking about Bitcoin and housing, because I live in sort of a suburban area, and you've just got millions and millions of these cookie cutter suburban homes that don't really have any character. They're just like a box, and they build them up. Like, you blink and there's a whole other subdivision with, you know, 200 more identical looking houses. And right now, these houses cost, I don't know, 20 or 30 Bitcoin. Are they worth 20 or 30 Bitcoin to me? Absolutely not. Are they worth 20 or 30 Bitcoin to all the other holders out there that have 70% of the supply and haven't touched it in at least a year? I highly doubt that. So I think, you know, these types of homes, you're probably going to be able to buy with less than a quarter of a Bitcoin in the future, especially as they just continue to build them. And Bitcoin continues to be scarce, and the halvings make it harder to acquire Bitcoin. So I don't really have a price prediction, but my goods/services prediction is, you know, 10 million sats for a home type of scenario. And I guess the only caveat there would be, like, coastal real estate. That actually kind of is scarce, because there's only so much beachfront property out there. Not that it's a better savings technology than Bitcoin, because you still have risk of a hurricane wiping out your house, or property taxes, or just a hostile government, or a fire, or any number of things. It's not a better savings technology than Bitcoin, but, you know, those types of goods won't go down as much in Bitcoin terms. They will get much, much cheaper in Bitcoin terms, but a lot of your goods that are very abundant, like, which is quite frankly most things, right? We can produce a lot of things. We can build more suburban houses. We can build more cars. We can grow more bread or bananas, or breed more cows and have more steak and milk and have more chickens and have more eggs. All of that stuff we can increase in supply, but we can't increase Bitcoin supply. So over the long term, all of that stuff just becomes cheaper in terms of Bitcoin.
Yeah. I think that was very, really well said. One analogy that I like is thinking, okay, in the year 100, how much would it cost to print or create, you know, 100,000 books, or store 100,000 books worth of data? And it's like, that would be, you know, you may not even be able to buy that back then. Like, it wasn't even possible. And now it's like, how much would it cost to store 100,000 books worth of data? Well, you can probably do it on your iPhone that's, you know, sitting right next to you, which is, like, quite mind-blowing. And it's like, that's what's going to happen with technology and with Bitcoin as the monetary tool. It's like double exponential of, you know, purchasing power for your savings that you have. So I feel like it's going to be a crazy couple decades.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it was you who told me this analogy. It's like, if you've got total global wealth as a pie, not only is the Bitcoin share of the pie getting bigger, but the pie itself is getting bigger because of what you just said with technology advancing, and having sound money will further that advancement of technology because you're not going to get all this capital misallocation. So yeah, it really is sort of impossible to conceptualize just how much one Bitcoin is going to be able to purchase by the end of our lives.
Yep, 100%. Mitch, enjoyed this. This was awesome.
Thanks for having me, Joe.